It's the Burt Cohen Show. Just recently in Guatemala, there was a great victory for justice. The former dictator who oversaw massacres was convicted of genocide in his own country, and that was amazing. And now, all of a sudden, a higher court reversed that court and has thrown the whole thing in utter chaos. Hundreds of people came to testify from out of the hills of Guatemala about the massacres they had seen that the army of Rios Montt carried out with the help of the United States. He was convicted. Who knows what's going to happen now? They may have to testify all over again. But one of the questions is, what about the responsibility that the United States has? Don't we have some degree of responsibility for that? Well, our guest today, our guest is Colin Snyder, assistant professor at the Department of History at the University of Texas in Tyler. He's the author of A More Systemic Fight for Reform, University Reform, Student Movements, Society, and the State in Brazil, 1957 to 68, and the Third World in the Global 60s, and is currently working on diploma factories. He also studies and teaches about both military regimes and Cold War politics. In 1999, a United Nations Truth Commission found Guatemalan security forces responsible for more than 90% of the human rights violations committed during Guatemala's long civil war. And shortly after that, President Bill Clinton went to Guatemala to apologize for that American role. He acknowledged that the Guatemalan military had not acted alone. American support for Guatemalan security forces had engaged in what he called violent and widespread repression. The president said, he said that was wrong. On May 10th, 2013, in a stunning trial, Efrain Rios Montt was convicted of genocide. And for many in Guatemala, the virtual invisibility of the American role in the trial was rather disturbing because the U.S. absolutely had a role. So today we're going to discuss with our guest, Professor Snyder, what the court did not discuss, the U.S. role, and what, if anything, can and should be done about that. Well, thanks again for being with us, and perhaps just a brief explanation. Who was Efrain Rios Montt? How did he come to power, and what was his regime alleged to have done and was convicted of?
Sure. He was he's a former general and dictator of Guatemala from 1982, March of 82 to August of 1983. He was actually born in 1926. He joins the military in his 20s, plays a small role in the CIA-supported coup in Guatemala in 1954, and sort of rises through the ranks in the 60s and 70s, and is actually serving as a military attaché to the United States by 1970. He ran for president in 1974 and lost, but then comes to power through a military coup in 1982, and it should be stressed that he's replacing another military leader, that Guatemala had military men in office from 1970 to 1986, and they usually gained office through elections that were generally fraudulent. And in 1982, he sort of comes to power through a coup that overthrows one of these generals. And in these 17 months that he governs, he sort of oversees one of the most brutal periods of repression in Guatemala's 36-year civil war, which sort of begins in 1960 and officially comes to an end with peace agreements in 1996. He suspended the Constitution so as to go after the so-called subversives. And in the course of those 36 years of civil war, you have 200,000 dead and 50,000 disappeared over three decades. But you have tens of thousands dead in 1982 alone, with 10,000 of them indigenous peoples. During his administration, he launches a scorched earth campaign in rural Mayan regions, destroying upwards of 600 villages and their inhabitants, dislocating about 1.5 million Mayan survivors, And these were the events that sort of led into his genocide trial here recently.
And so what was the awareness? I mean, what you described is just chilling. What was the awareness of these human rights violations here in the U.S. as they were occurring?
It depends where you look. With regards to the government, they believe that it sort of fell into the both sides commit atrocities mentality, that both, because you have guerrilla forces that were operating in the countryside in Guatemala, so it sort of took the regime at its word that a lot of the deaths in the countryside were at the hands of the guerrillas, where in hindsight that's very clearly not the case, that the military did commit up more than 90% of all the atrocities during the course of the Civil War. But the U.S. sort of was of the opinion that this was a civil war, at least the government, the administration, the Reagan administration was of the opinion that this was a civil war, and it pretty uncritically accepted the Guatemalan military's account of the events. But behind the scenes, and that's sort of publicly, behind the scenes you're starting to get emergence of the embassy in late 82 and the State Department becoming increasingly aware that perhaps these violations are going beyond beyond just the sort of both sides do it issue, that the state really is committing rather extreme human rights violations. And by 83, that's becoming increasingly clear, and you sort of have this chain of command and these debates going on with behind the scenes of politics, in which to what degree should the United States really be supporting this regime, given the evidence that's emerging for human rights violations. But at the same time, it should also be said that the government does kind of poo-poo the human, you know, institutions like Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch that were also reporting on these very blatant violations of human rights within Guatemala.
We are talking about the U.S. role in the Guatemalan genocide that happened under convicted and now not convicted General Rios Montt. Our guest today is Professor Colin Snyder of the University of Texas in Tyler. And I understand a newly declassified document characterizes Washington as being, quote, less concerned with the massacres than with their effectiveness. What would be, unquote, what would be the interest of Washington? Why would the people within the Reagan administration be concerned with the effectiveness? Was it trying to intentionally terrorize the population? Would that have been U.S. policy in Guatemala?
No, I don't. I mean, if you're referring to the document, I think you're referring to. I don't think that's the case. I think it's more that they're reviewing it as counterproductive, which again is, I mean, is no, you know, that's not to pardon it, because it's then taking into account massacres of civilian populations, not as this is a murder of innocent lives, but that, well, how effective is this to U.S. policy and to U.S. allies' policies? But yeah, I think that was sort of the issue, wasn't that the U.S. was actively seeking genocide in the region or the deaths of civilians, but that it did believe that such, you know, it did believe that Guatemala was in a civil war and it had to crack down on subversion, but it wondered to what extent were such widespread abuses really productive for the Guatemalan government in the region, for the forces against so-called subversion in the region.
Uh-huh. So the, you know, whether or not it was useful, it's a good question, and it's not to suggest that it's completely cold-hearted, but I guess, you know, it is kind of bad public relations for a government that we're supporting to be massacring its own people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no question about that.
And I have to read a quote from President Reagan in this. On December 4th, 1982, he spoke to reporters following his meeting with Rios Montt in Honduras. And this is words from then-President Ronald Reagan. "Well, ladies and gentlemen, President Rios Montt and I have just had a useful exchange of ideas on the problems of the region and on our bilateral relations. I know that President Rios Montt is a man of great personal integrity and commitment. His country is confronting a brutal challenge from guerrillas armed and supported by others outside Guatemala. I have assured the president that the United States is committed to supporting his efforts to restore democracy and to address the root causes of this violent insurgency. I know he wants to improve the quality of life for all Guatemalans and to promote social justice. My administration will do all it can, to support his progressive efforts." Comments on that, if you would, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is. I mean, that's been sort of the refrain in this discussion of the U.S. role in general in the academic communities, Reagan's praise there. I would say, actually, though, I think the quote, not that it's been abused, but I think context here helps, right? That it's sort of this off-the-cuff comment he gives to reporters in Honduras when he's traveling through South America, or through Central America, rather. And I think it sort of leads to a simplistic narrative that he absolutely is providing this sort of diplomatic and moral support verbally, but behind the scenes, you're already starting, when he gives that comment in December of 82, again, you're starting to see some within the government apparatus of the United States behind the scenes starting to question just how much, how close should the United States be allied with Efrain Rios-Montt. And I think the other issue at play here, and the sort of the bigger problem in the regional context with that quote, is not that we should praise Reagan for saying it or that Reagan was right in saying it, but what it sort of does is it masks the question of rhetorical aid versus actual real aid, right? That Reagan is saying these things about Rios-Montt, but he wasn't particularly close to him. He's giving this off-the-cuff mark that fits within Reagan's broader Cold War politics, and people sort of point to that as the symbol of Reagan's policies and repression in Central America, when in reality his administration is providing far more financial and material aid to other countries, right? That you have the Contras in Nicaragua who are trying to overthrow the democratically elected government of the Sandinistas in 1984 and 85 and 86. That you have the civil war in El Salvador from 1980 to 1992, where at one point the U.S. is giving about $1 million a day to Salvadoran military as it's going out into its countryside and killing its own civilians. So, that Reagan absolutely was grossly mischaracterizing Rios-Montt as getting a bum rap for human rights violations and that he was clearly committing and that he was not necessarily committed to social justice or democracy. But I think it's important to distinguish between Reagan's words versus the actual aid and financial materials that he provided to other Central American dictators, right? That this fits within part of a broader regional vision, and it's not necessarily anomalous with how Reagan saw the Cold War in the latter decade of the Cold War in Central America, but it's also not necessarily the purest form of the kind of actual real change and aid, damaging aid, that he provided to countries like El Salvador and Nicaragua.
So a couple of questions I have to ask there. One is about the Cold War, another about real military aid. Let's start with the Cold War. It seems like in Central America, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, and other places, frankly, as well as Vietnam quite a few years before that the Cold War context was kind of imposed on the realities of different parts of the world. You know, the Cold War had, the world was divided up either with us, the United States, or with the Soviet Union. There was like nothing in between. And nationalistic efforts, liberation efforts, such as what happened in Vietnam when the people of Vietnam wanted to be free from French colonialism, it was put in a Cold War context, and we saw the awful tragedy that happened to the Vietnamese people and the American people on that part, as well as Laos and Cambodia. And what, Professor Snyder, about the effects of imposing this Cold War picture on the realities of Central America?
Well, that's a good question. It's actually got a remarkably complicated answer because from the U.S. perspective, I mean, the way you sort of characterize things, that's absolutely the case, right? That the United States and the Soviet Union as its counterpart on both ends sort of see this, you know, the proverbial global chess game where you're trying to move pieces on a board and this is a battle of capitalism versus communism and sort of shaping it into terms of the United States on the one side of, and the Soviet Union on the other. But when you get into countries that are actually directly experiencing the Cold War themselves, it's often from their own national perspectives, right? That you have a lot of the struggles taking place in areas like Central America and even South America in the 60s and 70s where you have your own right-wing dictatorships, that these aren't really necessarily visions of politics imposed upon them by the United States or the Soviet Union, but these really are struggles that fit within national politics, that you do have groups pushing for broader social justice, that they'll draw on communism, but not the Soviet model, that they're pushing for land reform, that they're pushing for greater socioeconomic equalities, that they're pushing for greater economic independence from the United States. And on the other hand, then you have sort of these business elites or these conservatives or the military officials or a growing middle class that sort of fears the threat of communism. But this is often played it's played out in the arena of local politics, so that the U.S. is sort of perceiving the Cold War from one perspective that that see this as the United States versus the Soviet Union. But within countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, etc., this really is a question of national politics. That's not really how do we fit within the Soviet U.S. divisions, but how do we sort of lead the country the direction we think it should go. And you'll even see cases in Central and South America both where you'll have generals sort of raising the specter of communism and kind of playing the United States effectively, right? That they know that if you know, they just tell the United States that there's a communist threat, that they can get a lot more aid.
Right.
So they'll sort of call people communists who aren't and figure that the United States will be real quick to, you know, to perk its ears up and ask how much do you need. And that is actually the case in Central America, that you have instances in El Salvador and elsewhere where they say, oh, well, we've got communist subversives, help us out. And they don't really, I mean, they have people challenging the status quo, but it's not communism. But they know that if they use this language when talking to the United States, that makes it more likely for them to get aid. So I would sort of say it's not so much an imposition as it is national politics and manipulating global geopolitics for national political processes.
Oh, interesting. So it seems to, in a way, turn it on its head that not that we were so much manipulating them as they manipulated us.
Yeah, at times you do see that, and especially with the Reagan years, right? And that's part of, you know, that with the shift from Carter to Reagan, several countries in Central America sort of realize that if they frame it in this way with this guy who's campaigned as kind of a cold warrior, they're more likely to get a sympathetic ear.
Fascinating. Now Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan's immediate predecessor, cut off military aid to Guatemala in 1977 in light of human rights violations. Jimmy Carter was focused a lot on human rights. He specifically chose to stay out of Nicaragua when the Sandinistas overthrew the dictator that was, of course, supported by the U.S., Somoza. So he was focused on human rights and allowed, which is kind of a strange word to use. It's sort of an odd context, as if we, the United States, can allow. But he did not interfere so much in Nicaragua. That didn't happen until Ronald Reagan. It seems like Jimmy Carter may have had a bit of a perhaps more sophisticated view of realities in Central America, that it wasn't so much, us versus the bad commies. Now, Reagan certainly had a particular interest in fighting against national liberation movements who were called communists in Nicaragua and El Salvador. But Guatemala's government was so brutal that it didn't receive U.S. military aid right away when Reagan became president. What do you know about that? Was there some concern about the unique brutality of Guatemala's government by the Reagan administration?
Well, yeah, the great irony of this is, so Reagan's been in office for a little over a year when Rios Montt comes to power, that Reagan's inaugurated in January of 81, and Rios Montt comes to power in March of 82. And as I said earlier, that coup in 82 sort of brings not an end, but at that moment, it looks like it's bringing an end to this corrupt, fraudulent practices of the military and this brutality that have been taking place since the 1970s. That the Reagan administration is quick to jump onto this because they think this is a chance for an opening, right? That they had relatively not frozen relations with Guatemala, but that it hadn't been necessarily cordial in the first year or so of Reagan's administration. So with this new president, that Reagan sort of sees an opportunity here and tries to reestablish this aid. And he's not alone in that regard, right? And this is important to keep in mind and sort of decenter the United States a bit, that Guatemalans themselves initially thought that Rios Montt was going to mark a period of stability and, you know, a reduction in violence rather than an escalation in it. And in the cities, in urban landscapes in Guatemala, that actually remains the case, that they don't really experience the violence that the countryside does, that this is in no small part a campaign of ethnic cleansing on Rios Montt's part.
Oof.
But when that shift happens, in those first few months, Reagan actually thinks this is an opportunity to see some opening and some greater transparency and less violence in Guatemala, as many Guatemalans themselves do, especially amongst the elites. And so that sort of shift doesn't mark, that it is very much of its moment, that it wasn't just out of the blue, that there is this internal change in Guatemalan politics with the coup that Reagan thinks may go one direction. It turns out it goes the other direction, tragically, and Reagan's finding himself having to defend this guy at the end of 1982 with that quotation you mentioned. So that was the original reason for this shift in aid from not much aid in the 70s, even the first year or so of Reagan's administration, to suddenly let's start providing Guatemala with greater aid.
So would it be correct then to cut Ronald Reagan a little bit of slack here, that they didn't, when they restored the aid, the Reagan administration perhaps was not aware of how violent the Efrain Rios-Montt would be?
Yeah, I think that's fair, right? That, you know, you can criticize Reagan for a number of things, I suppose, but he certainly couldn't have seen into the future. And you look at the rhetoric from Rios-Montt at the time, and he is sort of talking about, you know, he wants to restore peace. That he's talking these sort of evangelical terms that might resonate with Reagan a bit about how the four horsemen of the apocalypse include things like subversion. So obviously that's going to, that subversion is one of the four horsemen in the Revelation, right? That's what it's referring to. That's going to resonate with in language and terms that Reagan could understand. But that, yeah, Rios-Montt himself was sort of taking power with this rhetoric of, you know, I'm going to provide stability, that we need to, you know, reduce the effects of the Civil War, we need to stabilize Guatemala, and Reagan took that at face value. And, you know, Rios-Montt hadn't really been in power, and in fact, it's sort of been, some had thought he was a leftist in the 70s when he ran for president and failed. So there wasn't anything necessarily that was going to, that was clearly telegraphing to the world that Rios-Montt was going to commit all these atrocities.
And these atrocities, when did they get committed? This is part of the focus of the recently concluded sort of trial.
Yeah, and they begin pretty quickly after Rios-Montt does take power, right? So he's in power. He comes to power through a coup in March of 82, but he's actually ruling with a junta. And it's only by June of 82 that he's sort of expelled the other two members of the junta, and he's now the sole sort of commander-in-chief. And that's when these atrocities take place, right? The 1982 sees, I believe, around, I mean, I've seen some numbers put at 75,000 deaths in 1982 alone. That's the whole of the year, so before and after he takes power, but obviously he's in power for almost 10 months of the year. And that includes about 10,000 indigenous peoples. And so that's sort of when this happens. It takes place relatively quickly, but again, because the United States is relying on reports from the Guatemalan government itself, when Rios-Montt says, well, this is, you know, a lot of subversive violence against the military, you know, maybe the Reagan administration should have been more critical in its sources, but that it was being told something that it was willing to listen to. But inside this, you know, at the lower levels of the State Department, the embassy and such, you're starting to get people saying, we think this may be, you know, more lopsided than Rios-Montt's government is letting on, and this is pretty clearly resulting in a lot of deaths, and, you know, some reports put at 1.5 million people displaced and internal refugees in Guatemala, so that's clearly going to, you know, that's not something you're not going to see. That 1.5 million people in a country that small being relocated is pretty visible to all, so that there were indicators that something was going on.
Is it possible, again, cutting some slack to the former president, that the military aid was restored prior to the military aid being used against the ethnic groups in the hills of Guatemala?
It's possible. At that point, you're getting into a timeline of a sort of day-by-day basis that I'm not confident in addressing explicitly. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a possibility. And the other thing to keep in mind here, too, is that it's not just the United States providing military aid to Guatemala, right? That some of its other allies as well, or some of its, you know, those who are in sympathies, share sympathies with the United States with regards to global geopolitics, that Chile is providing arms, weapons to Guatemala. Taiwan is providing arms to Guatemala. That Israel is providing arms. And in 82, in fact, Rios-Montt is saying that he can't, you know, they wouldn't be so successful against all these so-called subversives if it weren't for the help from the Israelis. So that, and that the Israelis had had arms deals with Guatemala going back to the 70s, so they'd simply maintained those arms deals. So this is an issue where even before Rios-Montt takes power, that there had been arms flowing into Guatemala, into its military governments, and Reagan restoring these his relations then, this isn't an apology for Reagan per se, but that he's part of this broader issue, right, where Guatemala is trying to get support from other groups, that this isn't strictly the United States and Guatemala versus the world.
And I wonder to what degree the so-called subversives really were subversives. I mean, Israel, Chile, all these other nations gave aid and obviously had some investment in Guatemala. I wonder what that investment was about. What did Guatemala mean to these Western countries? What was their interest in it? And were subversives really, in the big picture, a threat to countries like the United States?
Well, with regards to with regard to were they a big threat to the United States, I would say no. I mean, your mileage may vary, but it's hard to see really how Guatemala is a major threat to the United States in any real terms. Though that certainly didn't stop the Reagan administration from seeing threats, not just in Guatemala, but Nicaragua, that the Sandinistas in power was a threat to democracy, that, you know, you even have the invasion of Grenada because you can't have another Cuba.
Right.
But that with regards to what's in it for these other countries, it depends on who you were, I think. I mean, for the Israelis, it was really just here's an ally, and that Israel certainly has its own geopolitical problems that it has to confront. So it sees an ally, and that these arms deals are ways to sort of facilitate international support, and it's also a source of income for Israel. Chile, you've got the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet still in power, so that it probably takes that threat of subversion very seriously.
I imagine.
That the Pinochet regime by this point has killed almost 3,000 of its own civilians and tortured tens of thousands more in the same sort of right-wing anti-communist dictatorship in Chile. So that it can sort of see a brother in arms in Guatemala. In terms of the actual threat of, what were the subversives actually looking for, you have this sort of transformation. You'd had guerrillas movements operating since the 60s, trying to basically push for land reform and other issues that had begun in the early 50s under President Jacobo Arbenz that were ultimately derailed when the CIA helps basically creates a coup in Guatemala that sort of creates political instability that would last for much of the remainder of the century. So a lot of these subversive groups were wanting to just sort of continue those ideals of land reform and challenge imperial authority in the United States, of the United States in Guatemala. But in the early 80s, these groups sort of came together to form an umbrella group, the URNG. And that's when you really sort of see Rios Montt also cracking down significantly, right? That there's a sort of new unified guerrilla front rather than four or five different guerrilla groups operating independent of one another.
And so
were they necessarily automatically advocating communism? Some were and some were not.
Right.
Some guerrilla movements really were pretty, whether they're Maoist Marxists or Leninist Marxists, you don't really have any Stalinists of significance at this point. But some were, but others are just wanting broader social reforms, right? And that simply capitalism in Guatemala in centuries beforehand hadn't really demonstrated a path towards that kind of social equality. So they're looking for political alternatives to create more equal conditions.
Yeah, and my understanding of world history, such as it is that left movements rarely agree and generally have a lot of infighting and destabilize themselves that way, while the right tends to be fairly disciplined. If you just tuned in, we're talking to Colin Snyder, professor in Department of History at the University of Texas, about Guatemala, what's going on there now. It's hard to keep track of it all. And what was the situation? You talked a fair amount about the people wanting national liberation and land reform, and it's my understanding that in El Salvador, nearby El Salvador, there had been a ruling group of families, something like 14 families, if I remember correctly. They had all the power and money. Everybody else had not a lot. Has it been since the coup, the CIA-engineered coup in 1954, was that pretty much as it was? Was there a small ruling class and everybody else with not much?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as tidy as the 14 families in El Salvador, which, to be fair, isn't. I mean, it's a good phrase, but it's a little more complicated there as well. But yeah, you sort of have this very tiny oligarchy. And if anything, I'd say in Guatemala it might be even stronger than it was in El Salvador because it's still influencing politics today. And it's pretty much been able to compel the military to act on the elite's interests itself. So that you're absolutely dealing with this very tiny percentage of landed elites who are closely tied to the political systems, to political processes, to the economics in the country. So there's really gross inequalities in land distribution and wealth distribution. And so they're pretty effective in having the military work in their interests, or, sort of the military takes care of the politics and the elites take care of the economic side of things. And then, of course, once the military coup ends, or the military dictatorship ends and the civil war ends, and you're seeing the prosecution of people like Rios Montt, the elites can still sort of continue their what are often racist attitudes against indigenous peoples, without ever facing any of the legal ramifications from the war, because they weren't the ones who committed the atrocities. They simply supported them, but they were on the economic side of things, and they even continued to shape politics to the present in pretty powerful ways. And in some regards, the Rios Montt trial was kind of a test of how independent is the judiciary of those elite interests at this point.
Well, and the results of that are kind of disturbing to at least a lot of us. And basically, what happened, correct me if I'm wrong here, that Rios Montt was brought to trial. It was a very big trial. A lot of people came out and testified. The indigenous people. I don't remember the name of the Indian nation there. You probably do, but they spoke about a lot of the genocide that happened, where the troops just came in and wiped out whole villages, just destroyed whole villages deep into the countryside. And Professor Snyder, you talked about ethnic cleansing. I was a little bit surprised to hear that. And you talk about how the ruling elite has some degree of feelings, shall we say, against the indigenous population there. And I know that when I was in Guatemala in 1995, I believe it was, I remember traveling into the countryside, and there's a difference between the Hispanic people, the ruling class, largely white ruling class, and the people of, I'm not sure if it's Maya background or what it is, but, you know, they're rather short people and don't even speak Spanish. Tell us a bit about some of that, what sounds like kind of racism, actually.
Yeah, so Guatemala has been historically, even before there was a Guatemala, before Europeans arrived in the Americas, that Guatemala is a major center for some important Mayan city-states, right, in the highlands of Guatemala in particular. And so that then, and the Guatemala's population even to this present is largely Mayan, even after these episodes of, episodes of targeting indigenous villages during the Civil War. But you do have this very strong sort of racism then within Guatemalan society, or at least elements of it as well, that really view it sounds sort of backwards at this point, I suppose, but that you really have this sort of idea that indigenous are underdeveloped, that they're holding the country back, that they're lazy, often typical expressions of racism. And so that you have these elites who really are opposed to the indigenous populations. That I read somewhere, one elite commenter saying that it's the tragedy, real tragedy was that the military didn't kill more Indians during the Civil War. And so there is this very strong anti-Mayan sentiment amongst the elites who sort of imagine themselves as these purebred Spaniards or Hispanic background. And it also then taps, you sort of get this merging of race and class that feeds into this as well. And so these are sort of the issues that play with that sort of power structure and race within Guatemala itself.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds pretty ugly. I wonder what percentage of the population in Guatemala has been of Mayan descent versus the Spanish people. Do you have a guess?
Yeah, and I believe the official—I forget the official numbers off the top of my head—but I believe it's around somewhere. It's more than 40% for certain are Mayan, and then when you add in those who are sort of a mixed background, right, with Mayan and other peoples, whether they're Afro descendants or Hispanics, that I believe over half of your population in Guatemala has indigenous background of some sort.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of countries where one race, which is a minority, but sounds like here, well, it's not sure if it's an actual minority, has the rule over the majority here. And that is...
Oh, absolutely, yeah, no question. And there is this very strong sense of, and I use the term ethnic cleansing, because that's sort of what this trial was about, right? The genocide was, did they go after indigenous groups specifically? And I think, the one thing the trial did sort of establish pretty strongly through evidence was that was the case, right? That genocide are acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And that's certainly what they do. And it doesn't even necessarily mean you have to explicitly say we're going after Indians, but that the fact that they're going after indigenous villages and calling them subversives, right, that they're sort of masking this language of indigenousness in terms of politics. And they pretty clearly target, and that's what Rios Montt was on trial for, is for going after the Ixchel Mayans in particular, right, the IXIL, this Ixchel Triangle in Guatemala, where about 1,700 people were killed, where the government killed about 1,700 indigenous peoples. And that was, again, to give you sort of a sense of the racism even of the time, was at the moment that you had a minister, an evangelical pastor at the time, who commented that the army doesn't massacre Indians, it massacres demons, and Indians are demons possessed. They are communists, right? So you're sort of getting this really strange mixture then of religiosity, politics, and race coming together. And so that basically the army was targeting an ethnic group with support from some members of the Guatemalan society itself, and at that point you're basically entering the equation of ethnic cleansing, right? So they're trying to eradicate indigenous peoples from the social landscape.
Whoa, that's, yeah, some intense racist quotes there. Now, in the trial that just sort of concluded, he was convicted, Rios Montt was convicted of that genocide of the 17 approximately people. And what just happened in late May? Was it are there suspicions of, dare I say, extrajudicial interference in the decision by the Constitutional Court to overturn the conviction?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, basically, okay, so the trial started this year. It's only brought forth in January. Rios Montt was only brought forth for hearings in 2012 because he'd been a politician. He was actually in Congress until 2012, and he thus enjoyed congressional immunity.
Right.
So they finally bring forth the hearings, he starts to do this, and then we finally have the trial begin in the last couple months. And from the word go, the defense's tactics weren't necessarily so much to disprove or to prove his innocence as to challenge the legality of the court itself and to sort of challenge whether this could even happen and use intimidation and bullying, right? It's a very complicated, I mean, I'll try to be brief here, but it's a very complicated landscape with the contours of this trial where you have two judges operating in different ways, that one had been recused and then restored, but she said it had to go all the way back to the beginning, and another judge disregards her and says, we've got to push this through. And ultimately, then, he is convicted of genocide and human rights violations, again, for those 1,700 people killed. And that was really a landmark moment because yes. That was the first time that anyone had been found guilty of genocide in a national court. So there have been convictions for genocide, but they'd be at places like the International Court.
Right.
And it was the first time a Latin American president or leader, former leader, had been charged with genocide. That you'd had convictions for human rights violations in Argentina, that you had indictments for human rights violations in Chile and elsewhere, but that this was the first time you had one tried for genocide specifically. And so that verdict was reached on May 10th, and then on Monday, May 20th, the Constitutional Court listened to the appeals, not the appeals, but the defense had already put into place 8 challenges to the whole hearing process before the verdict was even reached. And what the Constitutional Court ended up ruling was that you have to go back to April 19th, that the trial needs to return to that date. And what that doesn't undo the entire trial, but it does open up a whole set of uncertain questions. Because by April 19th, all of the arguments had been made. That the defense and the prosecution had both presented their arguments, and it was about to enter the closing arguments phase. That all the evidence had been presented. So that the trial sets it back to that date. But the problem is, and what Rios Montt's defense team strategy will probably continue to be, is to challenge the system itself, right? That, well, you can't have this because it can't be an impartial trial now because the 3 people who were on judges or who were on the trial have already made clear that they think he's guilty, so we need to start over. And if you get new judges, then you have to start the trial over so they can hear the evidence. But throughout the trial, and even while it was going on before the verdict was reached, people on the scene were really sort of pointing towards a lot of intimidation and extra-legal bullying, not just from the defense team, but also from right-wing groups, from not paramilitaries, but sort of these right-wing militias, effectively, from members of the military themselves, that those conservative business elites who were really sort of tied to the project of the military government, if not necessarily to the violence itself, that you had people taking pictures of witnesses in the courtroom and sort of intimidating witnesses in the courtroom with threats, right? Vague threats. So if the trial has to start over again, will these people be able to go on stand again, or are they going to back down in fear for their lives? So yeah, the overturning, the way it stands as of today, May 23rd, it's not exactly clear to what extent intimidation played a factor, but it's pretty clear that it did play a factor to some degree or another. And that really had been the defense's strategy from the whole start, was to undermine the legitimacy of the hearings themselves and to intimidate rather than to ever actually address the charges of genocide. So as frustrating as the annulment of the case back to of the verdict and the case back to April 19th is, it doesn't take, and I think this is important to keep in mind, especially as we tell this story going forward, it doesn't take away from the fact that he was actually, not only was he convicted of genocide, but that the defense ever failed to provide compelling evidence that he had not been complicit in these human rights violations and this genocide, that those of us going forward telling this story can emphasize, even if, should he die remaining out of jail and found not guilty on a technicality, the courts ruled it and the defense was never able to disprove or to prove his innocence effectively.
Oh, that's an interesting and somewhat uplifting point there. I've been a little bit concerned. I mean, for the people, the survivors of the attacks, the assaults on the villages to come out into the city. I assume it was in Guatemala City. It's not easy to get there from the hills of Guatemala, and to do that. And to now face this intimidation, I mean, they've faced intimidation of real violence before. They worked really hard to secure the guilty verdict. I wonder if they're likely to be called back since their testimony is now kind of a moot point. Are they going to be expected to come back? And boy, that seems like a lot to ask for them to come back and do it all again.
Well, it does, but again, it depends on what does the resetting back of the trial to April 19th to do. If were the case to proceed in the following manner, in which, you know, everything that was submitted before April 19th stands, and they just have to re-listen to the closing arguments, re-present to the closing arguments, rehear them, and come to a new verdict, then they wouldn't have to, and that verdict is upheld, then they wouldn't have to return, right? The problem, the issue that comes into play then is if you get new judges who want to hear the evidence and see it all again. And even then, I mean, I don't know the legal details and technicalities in this regard, but I'm not sure if some of that testimony can be presented through transcript or not. Lean towards guessing it couldn't, but I'm not certainly perfectly clear on the niceties of courtroom procedure in Guatemala per se. So that would be an absolute burden. And that's why I did sort of end on a positive note there, but this is still a very real setback for justice, right? That you had this accomplished, and then basically through bullying and intimidation and technicalities, the minor technicalities, not substantial ones like falsification of evidence or something like that, that this quest for justice for these survivors and for their families was effectively undone. And it's not real clear now if you sort of have these two examples in Latin America, that on the one hand you have Jorge Videla, who had been the dictator in Argentina, who was found guilty for, you know, state crimes against humanity, for kidnapping, et cetera, and he just died this week on Tuesday, the 21st, I believe it was, and that he died in jail, and so that was sort of an example of justice accomplished. But on the other hand, you have Augusto Pinochet of Chile, who, although he'd been indicted and was under sort of house arrest and having to deal with ongoing legal issues, died in November of 2006 before ever facing trial. And so that's sort of the letdown of justice, right, that he couldn't face justice before he died.
Yeah.
And, the longer this takes, Rios Montt is 86 years old. The longer this takes, the more likely it seems that he ends up down the Pinochet path rather than the Rios Montt path or than the Videla path. And that is a major setback for justice, right, that in order to fully address the, not just address the past, but to try to prevent these kinds of things going forward, convictions are going to be far more effective at hopefully stamping out any future efforts towards this kind of state-sponsored terrorism than a failure to convict us, right? That there's sort of this phrase of the culture of impunity in Guatemala, and certainly with the annulment of the trial, at least as it stands right now, that culture of impunity did suffer victory and justice did suffer a setback in Guatemala. So this absolutely is, sort of devastating from a philosophical viewpoint and from the viewpoint of human rights.
Yeah, and a lot of us do care about human rights, and again, it's kind of bad public relations for any country to be in any way supporting of such things. And, in that trial, the prosecution, they must have been amazing, really. I have to give credit to them. But they never raised any issue, as far as I know, of American military backing or of the Army's war against the native guerrillas. Do you think if that had been brought up by the prosecution, the American military backing for the Army, might that have altered the outcome? Could the defense have used that to say, oh, it wasn't all our fault? Or what do you think, Professor Snyder?
I think it's okay that they didn't bring it forward in this regard, that basically Rios Montt was on trial for genocide and human rights violations and for orders that he himself made, right? I absolutely believe there should be a date and a time where the support that the United States provided sort of has it, there's this own day of reckoning, right? But that this was really a trial about the head of state of Guatemala ordering these executions, ordering these murders, ordering this targeting of these unarmed civilian population. And in that regard, then, I mean, the United States enables him through Reagan's comments, certainly he could interpret as enabling the weapons that were provided to Guatemala. But at the end of the day, it's still Guatemalan actions, right? That we enabled, we turned a blind eye to Guatemala, but it's Guatemalan elites, and in this case, Efrain Rios Montt and his intelligence secretary, who is also on trial but found not guilty, they're the ones who committed it, right? That bringing in the United States in this regard sort of is a distraction and doesn't necessarily tie into the trial that was taking place, the charges that were levied against these two men. But these were questions of, did you order the targeting of an indigenous group? Did you order the, you know, this ethnic cleansing? Was this a specific targeting of ethnic groups to exterminate them through actual killings, be it through relocations, be it through economic matters? And in that regard, the United States isn't directly involved. If, you know, if you're going to try to bring up the United States, in that case, you have to bring up, again, Israel, Taiwan, Chile, and they're really outside of what this particular case was about. And I fully agree with you that the prosecution did an excellent job in sort of pursuing this case, but I think it was in part because they focused on, you know, it's sort of back to what I said earlier, that the Cold War, from the U.S. perspective, was about the United States versus Soviet Union and arranging pieces on a chessboard.
Right.
But from the national perspective of those countries involved, who were the so-called pieces, this was about national politics and national social processes. And I think with this particular case, that's what they're trying to address, were national politics and a national human rights crisis. It's not even so much that I don't think that bringing in the U.S. would have changed the outcome. It's just it wouldn't have contributed anything to the actual case that was being tried. And if anything, it might have hurt because it would have distracted from Rios Montt's actual guilt, his culpability, right? That if you bring in the United States, you're sort of trying to shift the blame.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of the day, yes, they provided him the guns, but they didn't say, here's who you go after with these guns. That was his decision, and that's what this trial was about.
Interesting point. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Professor Colin Snyder, Professor, Department of History, University of Texas, about the ever-changing role of justice in Guatemala and the U.S. role in it. So it seems like perhaps these crimes, the genocide, could possibly have occurred without outside help from the U.S. and these other countries. But what guilt, if any, do you think the United States actually does bear in Guatemalan atrocities? You know, aside from the correctness of convicting Rios Montt because he did it, he ordered it, that's where the guns came from, that's the blood was shed directly because of him. What degree of guilt does the U.S. have? I mean, there's the School of the Americas, there's the U.S. involvement in defining Central America as our backyard, which I think is horrendously insulting to the people there. What degree of guilt does the U.S. have in these atrocities?
I think you could sort of say indirect guilt, the aiding and abetting, right? That that it knew when you're giving guns to an army that these aren't just sort of, you know, keep the peace. Well, you know, it's not some sort of pacifist effort here, that these weapons are going to be used for violent purposes.
Right.
But the atrocities themselves, as I said, are sort of coming from the government, from the very rich and complicated and often horrifying history of racial relations, of class inequalities, of politics in Guatemala. And that's really the case, I mean, from 1954 going forward and even longer back economically with sort of economic imperialism, that's the United States certainly and absolutely is guilty of aiding and abetting this, not just Guatemala, but other regimes, whether it's the Salvadoran military, whether it's the Contras in Nicaragua, whether it's the Chilean dictatorship of Pinochet, whether it's the Argentine dictatorship from 1976 to 83, whether it's Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, all of whom have dictatorships from the 50s or 60s up through the 80s and into 1990 with Chile, that we absolutely sort of, we absolutely are diplomatically recognizing these countries and providing right-wing regimes that are committing torture and repression on very broad scales. We're providing them with weapons, we're providing them with economic support, we're providing them with military support. But the School of the Americas that you brought up, there are absolutely men taught how to torture at the School of the Americas, that there are the sort of famous torture manuals, that sort of broader worldviews that play into this geopolitics of communism versus capitalism, these broader struggles of sort of racially categorizing subversive, that you see documents in the School of the Americas that, it's not hard, you don't have to make a big leap to see how military elites promoting racist ideologies are kind of picking up at least some of these ideas at the School of the Americas. Now, perhaps they had them before and they were just refining them further. But I think it's sort of this, how many degrees of separation do you have here? The United States isn't controlling these governments saying you really need to go after these people or you need to go after those. But we are aiding and abetting, and for every time that torture is committed or that we say, well, here's how to, sort of do counterinsurgency, as we put it, right? Every time you do that, you are aiding and abetting, and that you're tacitly and implicitly involved with these processes, even if you're not on the ground committing it, right? That if you're giving them the manuals on how to torture, if you're giving them the weapons, they might decide who's going to receive this, going to have their human rights violated. But at the end of the day, the United States at least plays no small part in aiding and abetting these kinds of regimes.
Well, this is sort of, I suppose, a philosophical question. For justice to be fully carried out, can at least individuals within the U.S. government never face any charges? I mean, there's people like Elliot Abrams and a lot of others who were, you know, deeply involved in this. What if they don't face any charges? Is that justice denied?
I don't think I would go so far as to say it's denied. I mean, I absolutely agree that, you know, there's sort of an unequal power system working here where those who commit violations and support violations in other countries face charges, while those in the United States who aid and abet it do not. But, and, you know, that's taps in these broader geopolitical inequalities that have gone back again for centuries at this point.
Yeah.
But, I think in an ideal world, it would help from a philosophical standpoint to discourage such support for such regimes in the future.
Yeah.
But practically, it's hard to see how that happens because I'm not saying this is bad. This is just sort of the reality, or this is good. This is just sort of the reality of the situation. At that point, hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. officials from all administrations are going to have to face trial somewhere. And regarding the idea of a completion of justice, again, I don't want to take away the U.S.'s role, but perhaps it doesn't hurt to decenter it a bit here either, right? That as the trial of Rios Mott reminds us, that the actions in Guatemala or, again, other places that enjoyed U.S. support, be it Argentina with its successful convictions or El Salvador where a culture of impunity also continues to reign, that they're part of national Cold War politics, that the sort of on-the-ground experiences of those people who lived in these regimes are very different. And I think you could say that the prosecution and conviction of leaders of countries who created these policies, so your Jorge Videla is in Argentina, or your Rios Montt, or your Pinochet's, if you can prosecute, convict these leaders and those who committed torture, you're providing a significant amount of justice, right? That the weapons and the financial support might have come from the United States, but that the decisions and the agency of the actors were national and not dictated by the United States. And so in that regard, I think, you know, trying and convicting those who ordered these kinds of actions doesn't make for an incomplete sense of justice just because U.S. officials, you know, who aided and abetted this process, Henry Kissinger is one of the more famous cases that people point to in this.
Yeah.
It would be nice philosophically to see that happen, but the sense of incomplete justice, I guess, in one way, philosophically, yes, that's the case, but that doesn't mean that it's therefore meaningless, right? That going after those who ordered these kinds of violations is still a very real progress towards justice.
Well, it certainly is, and I would hope that we learned. I don't frankly see, I mean, I'm a little bit surprised at what happened in Honduras, for example. There was a coup, and it seems that the U.S. is once again, despite President allegedly liberal Obama, we seem to be supporting another repressive regime. I don't know what you know about that, Professor Snyder.
Yeah, well, the coup, I think, and I haven't, it's still sort of unfolding a bit.
Right.
Of course, a lot of the documents and things we'd like to have access to aren't yet available.
Sure.
But that's another one that, like the one in Guatemala in 1982, in fact, seems to be homegrown, right? That the timing, sort of, I don't think, I haven't seen any strong evidence to suggest that Obama is directly tied to it, nor any good explanation as to why he would be. That it was June of 2009, that he's just come into office 6 months earlier. You know, the U.S. economy is an absolute mess. He's still dealing with how to get out of Iraq and dealing with the issue of Afghanistan. That Honduran politics are not a major threat to the United States politically or economically, and he just has so much on his plate that I'm not real sure how much it would be involved in that. And when you look at sort of the causes and the events of the coup itself, this was, once again, really about elites pushing back against any efforts towards social justice or reform, that you have a president who simply wants to have a referendum to determine if in the future presidents can we can do some constitutional reforms or presidents can get reelected, but he's excluding himself from that. He's not saying this is not for me to get reelected. This is to see, you know, test the waters of people are willing to amend the Constitution at some point. And just that, he sort of runs into the opposition from the business elites and from the economic elites and the political elites in Congress and then those in the court system and the military, and they sort of gang up and remove him from power. And I think the U.S., you know, Obama's young and, he's sort of green politically at that moment in executive politics. Mm-hmm. The U.S.'s approach, in some regards, was a bit encouraging because they sort of took a wait-and-see approach. Like, let's see what happens here. Let's not come out again. We're concerned, but we're not going to you know, it's disappointing they didn't condemn the coup immediately, but it was, given the U.S.'s history of coups in the past, and you can look at Venezuela in 2002 and how quickly they supported the coup of Hugo, that overthrew Hugo Chavez, only to have that blow up in their face. I think the wait and see approach was the right one. And they ultimately, yes, the regime, the government that took power was repressive, but the issue in Honduras is slightly different as well, because there you're dealing more with just a broader sense of police impunity in general that also has its roots with the United States in the 80s and going back further. But I think it's a fundamentally different issue. I think it's more a homegrown cause that caught the U.S. off guard, and we sort of tried to adapt to it without being too. And if anything, I'll say this, that, you know, this isn't necessarily defense per se, but the Obama administration was at least less involved, or less, you know, that in the past, the U.S. willingness to intervene quickly for one side or another and to try to pressure and shape politics in those very fluid and volatile moments was much greater. And in this case, they sort of took a step back and wait and see, and they waited to see how Brazil responded, how does Argentina respond, how it was sort of a more regional approach rather than the United States and Latin America, and we'll tell you what to do.
Right.
And that, again, there could be documents in the future that indicate that that's not the case. But as of right now, what we know about it, it seems to be that's really sort of how it worked out.
Well, Central America is always complicated, always very, very little understood by most Americans. We tend to be rather provincial, but it is important. And we will see what happens with justice, specifically in Guatemala. You've shed a great deal of light on this situation. Professor Colin Snyder, University of Texas, thanks so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show. And this song was written by Bruce Cockburn just as he left Guatemala, and describes a lot of his feelings about it.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. I would not.